an exhaustive look at the relationship between salt and high blood pressure.
Is obesity an avoidable cause of cancer?
What about chikungunya virus infection in the United States?
And the effect of a flexible scope on cancer mortality.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 15th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center, El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I said an exhaustive look at this issue of salt and high blood pressure. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine. Multiple studies, which we're not going to delve into in excruciating detail, but let's take a look. Do we finally have an answer to this age-old question?
Elizabeth, I certainly think that this is another piece of that puzzle that asks the question, is there an association between salt intake and high blood pressure, and particularly salt and cardiovascular disease? This ends up being a looming issue because high blood pressure, hypertension, is the most common modifiable risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And there are over a billion people in the world currently that have high blood pressure, and it accounts for more than 9 million deaths annually. So because it's so prevalent and so important, there's been a population-based approach to controlling high blood pressure. One of those approaches is limiting salt intake. So three articles in the New England Journal of Medicine address salt intake and either the issue of high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, or mortality. Two of the studies are reports of what's called the Prospective Urban Rural Epidemiology, or PURE study. They included more than 100,000 adults that were sampled from 17 different countries. Approximately 90% of these individuals had what was considered to be a high or a moderate intake of salt. And what they determined was that there was, in fact, a relationship between salt intake. Now, I say salt intake. They didn't actually measure salt intake. They measured how much salt was in the urine, and a single measurement, and they extrapolated from that. But there was a relationship between the sodium excretion and blood pressure. The more salt, the higher the blood pressure. It was really strongest in those that had the highest sodium excretion, those that were older, and people that already had high blood pressure.
Okay, so we've seen a lot of this before, and we've also talked before about the fact that, for example, hemoglobin A1C appears to increase as people age. If we try to too tightly control blood sugar, we end up with deleterious outcomes. People, if we just take a look at the natural history of blood pressure, it increases as people age. So how do we eliminate that factor and say this is the hypertension level that's problematic?
Well, they took this study a step further. They looked at sodium intake and cardiovascular disease and mortality. What they discovered was those that had the highest or lowest salt intake had an increased mortality compared to those in the middle range. These are relationships, don't necessarily prove causality. What we need is a proper randomized controlled trial in which we take people that have moderate or high salt intake and we randomize them to lower it or to maintain their diets. That's the only way we're going to solve this issue.
And we have to complicate it a little bit further by adding the genetic factor to that, because we know that certain ethnic groups, for example, African Americans, A, have higher blood pressure to begin with, but secondarily seem also to be more subject to the deleterious impact of salt in the diet. So I don't think we're even close to really knowing exactly what the mechanisms are here or when and if it's appropriate to intervene.
But I do think that when you look at really high salt intake, I think the data from this study and other studies, I think are fairly convincing that it does raise the risk of high blood pressure. And again, in certain groups more than others, but whether on a population base, telling everybody, oh, you need to eat less, where that actually makes a difference, that's still unproven at this point.
So would you go so far then as to say that some of these public health measures that are underway to really dramatically reduce the amount of salt that's in prepared foods, for example, are probably a waste of time?
I think the evidence would say we just don't know at this point. One of the interesting points about the study is those that had the highest potassium excretion had the lowest mortality. So it may be that you don't have to lower your salt intake, you just have to increase your potassium intake. And that's obviously diets that are rich in vegetables and fruits as well.
And then that drives us back to that old position of, does that mean supplements or does that mean diet? And on that note, I think we're going to leave this one alone. So let's talk about something that I think a public health aspect to it probably could have a really dramatic impact. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association, this virus chikungunya. And I already confided to you, I'm so proud of myself for learning how to actually say that. Came to us across the pond from Africa, hopped on some Caribbean islands to begin with, and now we have it here in the U.S.
And as you mentioned, we now have two cases of local transmission in Florida. chikungunya has finally arrived in the United States. It's a virus that's transmitted by mosquitoes, Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. And these are mosquitoes that are primarily in the southeast and in the southwest, although at least one of the species is found in the mid-Atlantic region and the lower Midwest. People that are bitten by mosquitoes and develop the disease, about 80% will develop symptoms, fevers over 102 degrees, usually within a week of the mosquito bite, rash, muscle pain, headaches. The treatment for it is just symptomatic. The way to avoid it is obviously to control the mosquitoes. No standing water in flower pots or boats or old tires that are sitting around the house. That's really the major way to control it. Elizabeth, what else do you want people to know about it?
Well, I think it's important to note that a lot of the people in the Caribbean report that they have these joint pains that are persistent. They can persist, and they describe them as excruciating for up to 6 months following the acute infection. And I think that that's something that, at least to me, since I've already got arthritis, says, wow, I really want to avoid this. The other thing I think it's important to note is that both of these types of mosquitoes bite during the day. So unlike other types of mosquitoes where we hear that common wisdom, wow, it's the twilight, be careful out there. If you hear that whine in your ear, get out the bug spray. The idea is, hey, protect yourself all the time, ahead of time, so that you don't end up getting bitten by these guys.
Yeah, so these insect repellents really need to be worn throughout the day.
I guess the good news is there's not really much of an association with mortality here.
Right. You feel pretty miserable, but it's not usually a deadly disease.
And I would also note that yesterday a press release came over the transom from The Lancet announcing that a really interesting and novel vaccine is actually being tested right now in humans for chikungunya. So there's some hope with regard to that.
And the last thing to our healthcare providers in the Southwest and Southeast, people present with flu-like symptoms, is they need to send off specific tests that can be done either at the CDC or in many public health laboratories.
So this is a reportable disease.
Yes.
From here, why don't we turn to, again, an issue that we've been talking about for a long time. That's the benefit of examining the colon and its impact on mortality. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association as well.
This is a very well done randomized clinical trial looking at whether routine screening in middle-aged individuals with flexible sigmoidoscopy can actually reduce the incidence of colorectal cancer and the mortality associated with it. And it's a trial of over 100,000 individuals between the ages of 50 and 60 years of age. And what they determined was that the use of flexible sigmoidoscopy over the course of 11 years reduced colorectal cancer incidence by 20% and cancer specific mortality by 27%. Most individuals don't have flexible sigmoidoscopy anymore. They have colonoscopy.
I think this is such a success story with regard to cancer screening, and certainly flexible sigmoidoscopy is a lot less onerous for whoever it is who's going to have the examination than colonoscopy is.
The groups are recommending different things. For example, the United States Preventive Services Task Force doesn't favor one screening technique over another. I guess what I would like our listeners to take away is my urge is that people be screened appropriately. They can talk to their physicians about what the best method for that particular patient would be.
Okay, that's a very strong public health message, and I'm happy with that one. We'll leave it there. Finally, then, let's turn to The Lancet, a look at another recurring question, and that's the impact of BMI, body mass index, and on cancer incidence.
And I chose this particular trial just because of the large number of patients included in this trial. This is a pretty comprehensive view. It looked at 5.24 million individuals in the United Kingdom known to have elevated body mass index. And over the course of the follow-up, which lasted for about 25 years, about 167,000 developed cancer. And they looked to see, was there an association between increased BMI and cancer? And they found that there was an association for 10 different types of cancer, about 62% increase in the risk of having uterus cancer, and about a 31% increase in the risk of gallbladder cancer, 25% increased risk for kidney cancer, and also an increased risk for cervical cancer, thyroid cancer, colon cancer, ovarian cancer, and postmenopausal breast cancer as well.
Yet one more reason not to carry around those excess pounds among all the rest of the reasons we know about and have talked about a number of times.
We know that people that are obese have increased incidence of inflammation, epigenetic changes, other things that can predispose to cancer. Just a 2 pound increase in weight in the United Kingdom results in about 3,800 additional patients developing one of those 10 cancers. I think an impetus for us to do the things we can to lead the active lifestyles, not only to feel better and to reduce the cardiovascular risk, but also to reduce the risk of cancer as well.
Indeed. Again, on that public health note, we'll leave that one. I'll reveal that this week on the blog, I'm going to talk about chikungunya because I think it's an important public health issue. And because I know how to say it, although I don't say it on the blog, but in any case, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.